The Senate Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order for February 21st. And first up on our agenda today is Senate File 1860, Senator Peterson.
Good morning, members. Good morning, Chairman. We have before you today a Senate File 1860. It relates specifically to a special provision that we want you to consider relating to concrete grinding. I know many of you have seen these crews working on the roadways these are the folks that actually smooth out the roadways. They grind down older interstate highways and roadways made out of concrete and make them smooth and drivable again, making them more safer and making them much quieter for road noise. We're here before you today to ask you to help us implement a provision. It's been a situation that's been a gray area for several years now, and you'll hear testimony to that effect. And we need a solution, which is why we're before you today, in hopes of changing the law and treating how we treat this slurry a little differently than we have been the last few years, and take it back to how we were handling it a little bit previously in the future. With that, we have some folks that I'll let them introduce themselves and give you a little bit more information in regard to this process.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Whoever wants to start, if you'd state your name for the record.
My name is Terry Kramer. I'm the president and owner of Diamond Surface Incorporated and have been for the past 23 years. Diamond Surface, Inc. is a highway maintenance company that specializes in diamond grinding, concrete pavement repairs, and rumble strip installation. Our office is located in Rogers, Minnesota. We also have a shop and manufacturing facility in Big Lake, Minnesota. We manufacture some of the specialized equipment that we use in our operations, as well as manufacture equipment for other contractors. Diamond Surface has 52 full-time employees. During the peak of the construction season, we reach about 100 employees. There are three diamond grinding contractors located in Minnesota, and we represent three of the largest in the industry, Diamond Surface being the smallest of the three, but the combination of the three companies employs as many as 400 to 500 people, somewhere in that neighborhood on an annual basis. Diamond grinding is a technique of using closely spaced diamond tip blades to plane the surface of the roadway. It's very similar to taking a rough piece of lumber and planing that down to a smooth board. The benefits of diamond grinding are many, but the three that are most obvious would be: we improve the rideability of the road. In other words, we make it smooth. And by making it smoother, we extend the life of that pavement. Secondly is friction. As a road gets older and ages, the surface starts to polish, and it loses its ability to hold friction. By diamond grinding it, we restore that friction. We restore the skidability, thereby making the roadway much safer. And the third thing that's very notable is we reduce the tire pavement noise. And this can be very beneficial, especially in the urban areas where you may have sound wall situations. By applying a diamond ground surface, we can actually reduce the height of those noise walls and ultimately save money. Let's see here. The process of diamond grinding is very cost competitive and is generally from $2 to $3 per square yard of roadway. That was prior to the new slurry rules. Alternate fixes or other methods that might replace diamond grinding can in many cases cost 2 to 5 times as much as diamond grinding. So it's a very competitive, low-cost treatment that lasts a long time. In fact, the durability of diamond grinding has been proven to last, and this is documented by a study done by Caltrans where they did a research on diamond ground pavements and found that they actually last from 16 to 17 years, and that you can apply that same treatment 3 to 4 times on the life of the same pavement. In terms of safer, there's actually research done by Marquette University And the conclusion of that research was that a dry road surface that's been diamond ground has 40% less accidents on it, and a wet weather road that's been diamond ground has 57% fewer accidents on it. There's a lot of benefits to diamond grinding. It's a great tool to have in the toolbox for maintaining our roadways. As I stated earlier, diamond grinding is a process of using diamond tip cutting blades to plane the surface of the road. In that process, we use plain water to cool those cutting blades. The combination of the cooling water and the material that's removed from the roadway creates a byproduct called slurry. In the past, we've been allowed to deposit that slurry on the inslope of the roadways that we were grinding on. If we were working in an urban setting, a city street or whatnot, then we would have to load that stuff into tankers and haul it away to a disposal site. In some cases, we are allowed in the cities or the urban situation, we are allowed to tanker it, truck it to a rural area, and spread it along the inslopes of a rural road. As the specifications stand now, all the material has to be loaded into tanker trucks and hauled off to an approved dump site. The area receiving the slurry has to be deposited, or the area to receive the slurry has to be deposited in a lined pond, and then that material has to be dewatered, and the solids that are left over have to be trucked off to a certified landfill. These requirements have dramatically increased the cost of our operation, and as far as we can tell, they provide no benefit. So you're paying a lot more money, the taxpayers a lot more money, to get no benefit. There's been many studies done on slurry itself, and most of the conclusions, or I think all the conclusions from testing and research from around the country, indicates there are no harmful effects of depositing the slurry on the inslopes of the road, as long as we follow the best management practices that have been set up by industry and handle it in a proper manner. Many of our neighboring states, such as Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, I can name just about all of them, they allow us to deposit the slurry on the inslopes of the road. I guess the reason I'm here today is this type of regulation that we have to follow in the grinding process is basically crippling the industry in which I make my living in, and it's also crippling those people that work for me. We know we've lost jobs because of it, and we're certain that we're going to lose a lot more jobs in the future because of it. So I would ask you to consider this bill here in light of that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Matt Zeller, and I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I just have a question for clarification for my own benefit. Slurry, at least in some other industries, it would be wet, and then when you dump it out, then would it harden? Am I understanding that right for your industry?
Yes. When we deposit it along the shoulder, the water would evaporate out of it, and what's left behind are the solids from the pavement surface that we ground off.
Thank you.
Senator DeCruyff.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. I have one other question about the slurry. Approximately how long? I mean, overnight, by the next morning, is this a dry product and a hard product on the edge of the road?
In most cases, it would be dry within 4 or 5 hours of us depositing it there, yes.
Can I have one follow-up?
Senator DeCruyff.
Is there a problem with runoff of this? Does it leave that area, or does it stay pretty well contained in that area?
Mr. Kramer?
It will stay pretty well contained in the area we deposited in, yes.
Okay.
Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, did your company work up in Duluth on the mega project? I know we did diamond grinding on a stretch of that.
Mr. Kramer?
Yes. I did not do the contract work up there, but we were hired last spring to come in and correct
to do the regrinding?
Yes. That was us.
Okay. So in a situation like that, where would you, Mr. Chair, in a situation like that, where would the slurry have gone? Because you don't have shoulders. You were at a very confined space.
Mr. Kramer?
That slurry was loaded into tankers and then hauled to a disposal site at Northland Asphalt.
Okay.
Mr. Kramer, where is Northland Asphalt located?
They're in the city of Duluth.
In the city of Duluth. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Zeller, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Zeller. I'm the Executive Director of the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota. I just brought you out a folder to try and hopefully answer some of the questions and also maybe get you folks to ask some questions as well. On the right side of your folder, you've got a document, the big slurry across the front, and it walks through the whole process of diamond grinding and some of the best management practices around the country for disposal. On page 3, up in the upper right corner, you can see a good photo that shows how the slurry is typically deposited up on the inslopes. Again, throughout this document, it talks about a lot of the different things that diamond grinding does and can do. The second document on your right-hand side just has MnDOT's old diamond grinding spec and highlighted in yellow down in section S1.3 is the way we used to. That was all the restrictions we had as far as depositing the slurry. Again, the big thing was we always had to keep it away from water sources. On the right-hand side, we've got a few documents that discuss some of the research that's been done on diamond grinding. As Terry alluded to, on the front of that packet is a reprint of an article from the Journal of Environmental Quality. And again, I don't want to get into a lot of that. You folks can read those for yourself. But as you get into the results or the conclusions on the back, pretty much it says that diamond grinding residue is inert and has no detrimental effects to the environment. Second document in there is an industry summary of that formal report. Again, just talks a little bit about what they looked at up at NDSU and has some of the test results. The third item in there is from the state of New York. Again, it discusses what's allowed, what's not allowed, how they worked with their environmental folks over there. On the second page, it's highlighted. Again, essentially what it says is the slurry can be deposited on the side of the inslopes. And the last research document that's in there was done by Caltrans. This final report up on the back. There's a flagged area on there because it's got an interesting part of the test they did out in California. It should be highlighted on page 6 under item 9 in conclusions. It says the 96-hour acute toxicity testing showed no toxicity characteristics for the slurry samples as manifested by the 100% survival rate of the fish test. Essentially what they did is they dumped this in a pond to see if any fish died. No fish died. Again, that's a pretty extreme test for the folks out in California. And this just goes to show, and again, I worked for 10 years for MnDOT, and my whole career there, we deposited the slurry on the side of the slopes. I saw no adverse effects from the diamond grinding slurry being deposited there. Once in the blue moon, we did have trouble where a hose broke or we let some slip into a stream, but that was corrected immediately. And again, no detrimental effects are showing out there now. With that, I just wanted to give you a summary of what's in there and see if you have any questions for us.
Thank you, Mr. Zeller. Any questions? Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And folks on this issue have been in my office, talked about it a couple of times. I've appreciated that. They gave me a little stack of studies. I slipped them under my pillow last night, but it just didn't work. So I'm still flying a little blind here. I mean, I've scanned the best practices document and some of the studies that have been done, and you know, don't doubt. I mean, it, you know, on its face seems like you know, it's a fairly inert substance that shouldn't be a big problem if you follow best practices. You know, don't dump it right into surface waters and things like that. We should be okay. My question, Mr. Chair, is does the language of this bill, Senator Peterson, does it follow? I mean, I just, you know, I I was looking at the best practices, slurry handling best management practices guides from the Diamond Grinding Institute. Who knew there was such a thing? Does what's in this document, is it reflected in the bill that you're proposing, Senator Peterson?
Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I did just check. We believe that it is based on the best practices we've seen here in Minnesota. When I first heard about this idea myself, I realized I know some of you better than others as senators in this body. And when I first heard about it, I shared the same environmental concern that some of you have expressed already. And I can assure you, as a member of the Environment Committee and as a member of the Clean Water Council here in Minnesota, I wouldn't be moving this bill forward if I didn't feel like the environmental concerns were addressed. But in checking with Mr. Kramer here, the 100 feet is adequate. Have you learned something else, Senator Dibble? Okay. We believe it is, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
In some of the discussions that I've been involved in, we've talked about the chemical makeup. Just real briefly, I believe what we have talked about is that through this process, the major chemical reaction with concrete happens during the process of the concrete setting up and actually becoming a stable road surface. And so the chemical reactions and all of that have taken place. Would you touch briefly on what the chemical makeup is and what the major component is of the slurry itself once that's involved in this process, in the grinding process? I think you talked about lime. Is the lime being a major part of what the makeup of the slurry is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what's left once the water is out of the slurry is the solids that were contained in the concrete itself. Some of the studies that have been done on it suggest that it's basically about the equivalent of farm lime at 65%. If you looked at slurry, you dewatered it, and you had a handful of it in your hand, it looks like very finely ground concrete. So it's basically, at that state, it's an inert material. But the chemical process that you're suggesting there, I don't think that I'm qualified to talk about that, but the concrete has gone through its hydration and gotten hard, and you don't have that reaction taking place again as we grind it, or as you deposit that slurry somewhere on the slopes of the roads or whatever. It's already gone through that, and it's not going through it again.
Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Chair. Gimsey, for Senator Peterson or testifiers, say, in the examples you've given us from other states, this is addressed in departmental policy, and I know MnDOT hasn't testified yet, and they're on the list. I mean, is MnDOT's stance that they won't go this route, and that's what necessitates a statute change? It seems like maybe there's an intermediate step below changing state statute that could be addressed.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Reinhardt, I'll address that first and let the testifiers add their views as well. I think from my perspective, what I have been shown is that there is a great deal of confusion surrounding this issue relating to who has authority potentially and how we're supposed to handle this, relating to the Minnesota Department of Transportation as well as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I think you'll hear that this industry has worked hard on trying to get this issue addressed, and I think this bill is the result of some frustration, I think it's fair to say, and the inability to implement changes that we believe are reasonable and will quite frankly allow essentially 50% more of the same repairs to happen. Can you imagine doing 50% more of the work with the same dollars the Minnesota Department of Transportation has available for this type of repair, being able to do double the amount of work by this simple change? I think that's the issue we're trying to address for our residents in Minnesota, and trying to make our transportation dollar go farther than it is right now. So,
but Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, you feel at this point statute's your only recourse?
Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinhart, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got one question on line 1.11, and it's the word requiring. I'm wondering if that word shouldn't be allowing to be more flexible, because this says requiring deposit of slurry along in slope of the roadway for diamond grinding. So this is requiring it in the contract rather than a provision allowing MnDOT to do that. And, you know, because maybe a contractor chooses not to do it another way, but this is saying that you are going to do that. And I'm just wondering why we're not using the word may or allowing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, we have reviewed this, and we're more comfortable with the word require, because I think right now there has been provisions. I think there's provisions for special programs and that type of thing. And it's a matter of being competitive in other states as these contractors seek to generate work, and we have reviewed the bill and would be more comfortable in asking the DOT to allow this as a common practice rather than being able to choose when they want to do it and when they don't want to do it.
Senator Hall?
But Mr. Chair, can you tell me why requiring it? That seems like a mandate that we're requiring it rather than allowing it. I would think if we want to be competitive, we'd let people just... You know, you're going to have a provision in there that it is allowing that to happen. So the MnDOT couldn't say, well, you can't do that because it's going to have a provision allowing you to do it. But now you're taking a proactive stance saying you are requiring it to do it. And to me, that might have an unintended consequence somewhere along the line.
So that's just an allowing story. I think that would be fine as long as they have to have it in there.
Mr. Chair and Senator House, so your proposal would be to have an oral amendment that would just change that word from requiring to allow. Is that what you're suggesting?
Allowing.
Senator Hall.
Allowing.
So, Mr. Chair, yeah. Would that be a friendly amendment that you could accept?
Allowing.
Allowing? At 1.11, just striking the word requiring and put in insert allowing?
Well, Senator Howe, or Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, I think we certainly would give that serious consideration. You know, would you be willing to offer that bill on the floor with an assurance from me if we move this bill forward today with requiring, and I'll get together with you on that and review that language and then potentially offer that amendment on the floor?
Senator Howe?
Where else is this bill going? Is it going straight to the floor, Mr. Chair?
It's going to be held over for inclusion in an omnibus transportation policy bill. So there will be some time to have some discussions on it. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair. To this specific point, thank you, Senator Howe. I had a concern around that as well, just from our conversation regarding the mega project. And if you had done that work and would have been required to deposit it on the end slope of the roadway, that causes me concerns. There is no end slope on that roadway. It had to go somewhere else. It's a completely confined stretch of roadway. So, I mean, I would encourage Senator Howe to make the amendment now. I mean, that's what committee work is for, and it allows the flexibility for the contractor to, in that case, say, nope, we can't do that here. We'll ship it off to Northland, who has a place to store it. But where it makes sense, then we can do it.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, unless you have a strong objection, I'm willing to go with whatever you decide. It's your choice. But I think this just gives you flexibility.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, yep, no, at this point, to try and address Senator Reinhart's concern, yeah, starting in line 1.12, you know, the bill clearly prohibits a contractor from allowing slurry to flow across lanes of traffic or into gutters or other enclosed drainage facilities. So, you know, I'm not sure if you thought that would address the concern that you're referring to in Duluth, or not. But to that point, Senator Howe, I'm sorry, Mr. Senator Reinhart, I guess I don't really need an answer to that. But we have been we would allow that change, Senator Howe, if you'd be willing to make that that Doyle amendment. So.
Senator Howe. Mr. Chair, I'll offer that amendment, striking 1.11, the word requiring, and inserting allowing.
Senator Howe has offered a verbal amendment on line 1.11, striking the word requiring and replacing it or inserting the word allowing. Any discussion on the oral amendment? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to pile on here, Senator Peterson, but I'm just wondering if even all the language on 1.12 to 1.14 is perhaps too prescriptive for state statute, and you may want to consider having some sort of language that allows the Commissioner of Transportation to describe to follow best practices. I'm just thinking that, you know, it's pretty specific here in terms of 100 feet from natural streams and lakes or 3 feet from water-filled ditches, for example. You may want to have language that allows the commissioner to set guidelines to that effect so that it can be changed and not have to be modified through statute.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, my understanding is that this language comes specifically right out of the best practices, industry best practices manual. So that's why they were put into the bill, again, so that everybody's clear, you know, in terms of what's allowed and what's not. As folks are coming into and bidding these projects, it's important for them to understand what's allowed and what's not, and that's why we chose to put the language right in the bill. So we would prefer to leave that as it is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I'm not disagreeing that following best practices is a good idea, but perhaps even just specifying the best practices as described in whatever manual or procedure you use to identify what the best practices are may be more flexible in the long term, so that if the best practices change, then you're still following the best practices without having to not be in compliance with the statute. It's just an idea.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, just one thing. I think we could do something along those lines as long as it referred to industry best practices. If it went to MnDOT's best practices, that's what got us in the boat we're in right now. Their best practices are to vacuum it up and containerize all of it. And we've tried to work through that and have had very little luck with that. So, I think not being so specific and allowing it to change with the times would be a good thing. But essentially, we tried to copy the most important parts out of the industry best practices and make sure we had them addressed in this.
Senator Hall, do you have a question?
No, I don't have a question. I'm just going to wait for us to vote on the amendment.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, is there anybody in the audience who wishes? No, we still have one more testifier from MnDOT, Office of Environmental Stewardship. Welcome to the committee.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Pafko. I'm MnDOT's Director of the Office of Environmental Stewardship and Chief Environmental Officer for the department. Thought I'd start this out by saying the first sentence of this bill requires MnDOT to have a special provision concerning the slurry from concrete diamond grinding and saw cutting. We do, as testified before. So the bill does not require does nothing if to tell us to have a spec. However, as noted by the testifiers, that special provision has changed recently. And I think it probably is useful to tell you the story of how that changed. In 2008, the U.S. EPA, in its instructions on the General Construction Stormwater Permit, NPDS stands for National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, which every construction project that disturbs over 1 acre of ground needs, required the states, in this particular case, MPCA administers the NPDS program for the U.S. EPA, required that concrete washout, first declared concrete washout water as a waste, and required that specific management practices be incorporated into our NPDS permit to manage that waste, and prohibited the discharge of that wastewater where it could lead into waters of the United States. In February of 2009, the MPCA issued general guidance saying they were going to be changing their permit, and that we were going to, our permits, as ones that were already underway could go, but new ones were going to have to incorporate these new provisions. Now, concrete washout water is pretty much universal on every concrete construction project. It's what they do when they wash out the mixed trucks or the chutes or their tools or the boots of the guys that are walking in it. And it required that. The volume of that is relatively small amounts, and it's manageable for the industry to handle that. The MPCA in its guidance also said that slurry water from saw cutting or grinding was also covered, was also similar to this and covered by that permit. We reacted to that, initially in a piecemeal fashion. We heard complaints from the industry that some contractors were trying to do good, put this into their bids, and then we're getting penalized because other contractors weren't bidding this and kind of, in the contract, so there was an uneven playing field. They wanted us to have a uniform specification, which we did. The specification, which has been mentioned, we applied it not to just concrete washout water, but also saw cutting and diamond grinding. Basically, the difference is you've got a small amount of water from washout, you've got the same, maybe a little bit of more from saw cutting, and you've got an awful lot, orders of magnitude more water from diamond grinding, much larger area. They needed to lubricate the diamond heads, so you're dealing with thousands, potentially tens of thousands of gallons of the slurry, which is why we specify collection into a tanker truck and placing it in a location where the water can evaporate and get us down to a manageable amount to dispose of. Does this add cost to the project? Absolutely. And we've been trying to find a way to reduce that cost so we can put more of those dollars into improving our transportation system rather than finding cheaper ways to comply with environmental regulations so we can put more money into our system. In 2010, this material is considered a solid waste, and yes, a liquid can be a solid waste under definition, and you can't dispose of it. But you can find a beneficial use for it. Take a look at something in the concrete industry. Fly ash is a byproduct, is a waste of burning coal at a power plant. We use fly ash as an amendment into concrete mixes, and it's actually pretty good. It's tied up. The heavy metals that are in the ash are tied up in the concrete. We think that's a very good beneficial use, and we do promote that, and we work cooperatively with the industry and the PCA to do that. The beneficial use we tried in 2010 was to try to get these fines incorporated into our shoulder. It was a project on I-90, southern Minnesota. Off the edge of the pavement, they dug a shallow trench. We allowed the water that slurry to be deposited in there. As part of the requirements of the BUD, we were in the process of getting a case-specific BUD. Ultimately, that could, in a BUD beneficial use determination, work that in. That's underway. We're still waiting to hear back from the PCA on that. We have also offered, with the discussion about let's deposit it on our roadsides. And that, you said here, it's very similar to agricultural lime. And there are situations, just like in a farmer's field, where liming it is a good thing and is a way to increase the farmer's productivity. But the farmer doesn't apply it everywhere. He tests his soil to determine what he needs. He applies it as a specific rate, and he incorporates it into that soil. We would like to, in a bud, and what we've offered to work with on there, is let's find a road, let's go to a project, test the soil to determine if, in fact, this very high pH slurry and ag lime would have an effect on that, would have a beneficial effect. Actually, our in slopes are some pretty stressed environments, and sometimes getting vegetation to grow can be difficult. So if this is, in fact, a good soil amendment, we would, of course, as a soil amendment, not just allow it to be sprayed on the grass, because what you end up after the water evaporates is white grass. The next time it rains, it's either going to filter down into the soil or run off into the bottom of the ditch. Eventually, it's probably going to get incorporated in the soil, and one of our concerns is that we would have impervious, that those fines, very fine particles, could reduce the ability of water to infiltrate into our side slopes. And our ditches is our primary water quality method to improve stormwater runoff from our roadways. It's the most cost-effective, and it's been around since the time of the Romans. We'd rather do that than build ponds and other structural means to improve our stormwater quality. So we're willing to... We've had that offer to work on additional beneficial use determinations on project-by-project basis, because we want to reduce the cost of our environmental compliance. At the end of the day, PCA is reviewing the information that the industry has given us. If it is true, if it turns out as information that we have been given, that it's a part of our national pollution discharge elimination system and a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act. If the state legislature does a law telling us that we have to incorporate this into our specs, it puts our engineers in kind of a bind. Have to comply with state law, they would be violating federal law. And a knowing violation of a law can put their professional engineer license in jeopardy. If, in fact, it's perfectly benign and it's not regulated under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, PCA says it's okay to spray it, you don't need to pass a law. We will change our spec. The other thing is, we're still willing to work with, if this is still a waste, it has to be regulated in some manner, but we can find a cheaper, beneficial use of this, we will work with it. And I'll stand for questions.
Senator Peterson, did you have a comment on that? Otherwise, I have a few questions. Mr. Pafko, are other states depositing this right into the inslope on our highways as they're going through this process? Are there other states in this country that are doing that?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes. I have one personal experience on a trip to Michigan, on a tour looking at a diamond grinding job, asked the engineers what they did with their slurry. They looked at each other and they said, well, they got from the Michigan equivalent of the PCA, got a beneficial use determination that they could spray it on the back slope as a way to control noxious weeds.
In your opinion, is there any dispute about the toxicity of this or the potential for harm to either animals or the environment? To the best of your knowledge, did the industry reflect what the makeup of this slurry is?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is they have produced tests from other states. Tests are not comprehensive. We do know this is a very high pH, not hazardous, but still, 11 to 12 pH material, which can be useful in acidic soils in improving the productivity. However, in already basic soils, it's probably going to do more harm than good. We would also be concerned about any trace heavy metals that are in the material, and we're going to need to test that to determine, and it may be very specific on the source of the concrete. We know, at least EPA has told us, that generally the concrete slurry material is very high in chromium. Depending upon the source, if in fact, let's say, fly ash from a power plant was used in that concrete, then any of the heavy metals that we had wanted to be tied up in that concrete, which might be mercury, lead, whatever, that was in that original coal, might also be in that slurry. So we don't have enough information right now, and I think we believe it's probably very specific to individual concrete and its source material.
So in your final conclusion, then, what you're saying is that most likely if you had your way and MPCA had their way, we will continue for quite some time paying 1.5 times what these projects should be costing us and using our state very limited state road resources to continue this practice of hauling this, what appears by all of the tests and a reasonable evaluation of what we've seen here today, an inert substance to another point someplace and end up with the same result. Once it's dried out, you still have this dust, and really, what have we accomplished? So, but in your opinion, then, how long do you think we'll continue with this practice of paying 1.5 times the amount that we would pay otherwise if we were to incorporate this into the roadside ditch?
Mr. Chairman, our offer to the industry stands. We are willing to work on a project-by-project basis, which is all we have right now, until the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency can issue what's called a standing beneficial use determination. We have to go through case-specific. We're willing to work with cheaper methods to manage this waste material. And if, in fact, we can manage it on our by spraying it on our roadsides, incorporating into our inslopes, we are perfectly willing to do that. We are not in the business of trying to raise the price of transportation projects on a whim.
Well, I appreciate that. I know that you probably work very hard and diligently, but these are the types of things that frustrate us as legislators when our contractors and our constituents come forward with solutions to problems and get met with stalls and delays in trying to do what is best and what they understand is best within the industry. And this bill is a result of, you know, that frustration. And you even cited yourself a study that began in 2010 that you don't even know where that study is at this point in time. You're looking at what the results might be in another study on the backslope. And then you make the point that this lime may not be beneficial to roadside ditch dirt, where it is beneficial to farmers. Well, farmers are producing a crop on their land, and we're not trying to produce anything in the roadside ditches that I know of in the state of Minnesota that is of productive nature. And you also said that it could potentially stop noxious weeds, which I think is a beneficial aspect of putting this down in our roadside ditches also. But do you have any science at all for us that would lead us to a conclusion that we have to make a decision other than to allow this practice to move forward? Anything scientific at all?
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot in that statement. The answer is yes. We are dealing with the science. The experimental research project, that experimental bud that we worked on, that report was developed by a PhD toxicologist who works for me, and I do exactly, and I know where it is. It's at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency awaiting a response. I did not say that this was a useful material. What's some other things? I did not say this was a useful material for noxious weed control. I said the Michigan Department of Environmental Protection and Department of Transportation said it was. That, and I took that to be a very tongue-in-cheek statement. I do not believe it is useful for that. I do believe it can, in certain circumstances, have a beneficial effect and on vegetation in the roadsides. And while we are not producing a crop, we do want to grow good vegetation on our roadsides for erosion control purposes, to reduce runoff, to reduce pollutants into waters of the state. We want to have good native or good vegetation that will inhibit the growth of noxious weeds, so we don't have to spend maintenance dollars to go out and spray it. So we do want to use it as an amendment, soil, you know, as where it is beneficial. But we need science to determine where it is beneficial. As I have stated before, some farmers, when conditions warrant in their field, use similar materials to this to improve their productivity. But they do not spray it everywhere, and they do not treat ag lime as if a little bit is good, a lot is better. They use it in very precisely measured quantities where it's needed to improve the productivity of their fields.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think you can begin to get a sense for the debate that's gone on the last several years surrounding this issue. I can give you some comments relating to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I did talk to their government affairs staff person about 12:45, just I guess a little over an hour ago, as our Senate session was ending, and he shared with me that they would not be taking a position on this at this point, and I think that demonstrated that they're neutral on it by the fact that they're not here. He told me there would not be anybody coming to testify in favor or against this issue today unless that's changed and somebody's here. My sense is you'll probably confirm that. But I think you can understand that the issue that this industry is caught up in right now, as you heard, they're using a significant volume of water, and I really take issue relating to violating the federal law, because I think there'd be a clear message to the other states that are allowing this to happen, particularly if this happened back in 2008. Members, you know, we're approaching the construction season 4 years after that change, and I find it difficult to believe that all these other states would continue to operate in violation of a federal law. I appreciate the work and the efforts of both the MPCA and the Department of Transportation to do things right. But members, that's why this bill is in front of you, because of the conflict and the testimony you just heard. These two state agencies are not bringing a solution forward on this issue. And I'm sorry to be here, but we're going to ask you as legislators to make a decision on this and give these agencies a direction on what you would like to have them do. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And members, I really do want to, before this, it seems like, a couple of issues got mixed together when there was a determination made about the concrete washings. Somehow the already dried, cured, existing concrete crumblings or whatever they're called kind of got swept up into that determination. So that's what's frustrating. I share your frustration very much. Without any, separation of those two different, very different sorts of substances, washing out the inside of the concrete trucks and washing off boots, with material that hadn't yet dried. That's a completely separate matter. But on the other hand, it it's not as simple as necessarily meets the eye. I wish all this time later there was a little more definitive information. I appreciate these studies, but even one of these studies that was handed out says that, not all concrete is created equally. And Mr. Pafko even identified, when there's fly ash, and the conclusion of this report does talk about, when there's fly ash, that might be a problem. When the the resulting slurry, you know, what's left over after the slurry dries is too fine, it has some impact on the porosity of the soil. So, you know, it does sound like these situations need to be understood a little bit better on an individual basis or on a best practices basis. It's frustrating because I'm standing squarely on both sides of this issue. You know, I want inert, harmless material that might even be somewhat beneficial just to be dumped along the side of the road where it's not going to really cause any trouble. I don't want material that might have these heavy metals, you know, with the fly ash that might get released, you know, that was otherwise previously bound up, that might be too fine, that might impact the porosity and the subsequent water quality because the water is then not able to infiltrate. I don't want those sorts of practices to occur. So I'm finding myself in a little bit of a quandary, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if a tiny bit more work might be in order, and we ask the Environment Committee to take a look at this, to consider this issue just a little bit more closely. Maybe we can find the solution, the middle ground, so that we can, in time for this construction season, for a solution that I think fulfills the very well articulated shared goal of letting this stuff just be dumped on the side of the road, but in a way that's environmentally benign.
Senator, I think we'll have the testifier go ahead here. Mr. Kramer, or Mr. Zeller, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, just to make a couple of points about the research study you have in front of you, the North Dakota State study, I think you're looking at, that has those remarks about fly ash in there, mm-hmm. if there happened to be fly ash in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty certain the I-94 material they did sample had fly ash in it. Minnesota's been using fly ash in their concrete for, probably 25-plus years now. And I'm pretty certain when we did that job, when that was ground, what was sampled from there and tested, had fly ash in it, probably at our lower percentage when we used to use 15%. We use 25 or 30% now. But I'm pretty sure that was in there.
Mr. Chair.
And then
I'll just go ahead and let it finish. One
last comment on the heavy metals in there. Concrete is, you know, when it was developed by the Romans, it's artificial stone. So the cement, the fly ash, the water, they all react in a chemical process, and you can't step on a piece of concrete and get the chromium back out of it. It's chemically reacted. So it's not like it's a powdered cement anymore with these available metals. And, again, it just most of the studies you look at, you'll see a very small amounts of those heavy metals.
Well, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, you know, the language of the conclusion itself says current CGR materials, which is what we're talking about, at least those represented in this study, do not present a hazard, et cetera, et cetera. But changes in concrete aggregate composition could alter this picture in the future. In recent years, fly ash and other non-traditional materials have been introduced into concrete mixtures. Some of these materials have been shown to contain substantial amount of substances, particularly metals, that are considered hazardous in some situations. And then it goes on to also talk about seeing if they can't develop the grinding process to produce coarser material that would be beneficial, of course, to the mechanical properties of the soil. So this is, you know, this is the conclusion language of the study itself. You know, produces enough question marks in the air to wonder, you know, it says that, you know, certainly some concrete is fine, and if it's done in a coarse, you know, if the resulting material is coarse enough, it's okay. But if it's ground too finely, it might liberate some of these heavy metals, which is bad, and impact the mechanical properties of the soil, which is bad.
Senator Correa?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pavko, I have a couple questions for you. First of all, do you concur with the Caltrans analysis on their environmental impact of slurry?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I am, at this point in time, we have not completed review of that Caltrans study and was just furnished to us yesterday, and so I cannot answer that question.
Okay.
Senator DeCraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, in my experience working with Caltrans, and I have some, I found them to be pretty thorough in what they do. So I guess when I saw a Caltrans study, I guess I looked at it with a little bit different just because I've had experience working with them. But I have another question, and when you look at the cost to business compared to the cost to environment, do you look at that at all when you make a determination, or doesn't your department look at that ratio at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator DeCuff, the cost benefit of a project is looked at, and I believe the testimony earlier from the contractor talked about the potential of losing jobs, and the potential of losing jobs would be if the cost, you have a piece of pavement that needs some rehabilitation. You can go to a concrete rehabilitation, you go to an asphalt overlay. And I think the concern from the concrete industry is if the cost of concrete rehabilitation rises too much, they will lose business because we will tend to choose asphalt rehabilitation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator DeCraft.
Actually, I'm personally not looking at this from a loss of business perspective, but from a cost comparison to what the environmental impact is. Does your agency make a practice of changing policy like this without the science being there really to back it up yet? I mean, it seems like a determination was made that turned out to be very expensive to business and the state of Minnesota in this case, when it seems like you don't have the science really backing you up yet. And what my question is does MPCA do that on a regular basis where they change policies like that that cost business and the government thousands and tens of thousands, millions of dollars without really having the science to back it up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I have been part of the regulated community for 35 years. The rules and regulations and the permit requirements are not getting easier. They are changed often and usually much more strict. We do not change our environmental regulations according to science as much as we change, or I should say our environmental specifications to the science as much as we change our environmental specifications according to the changes in the regulations.
Okay, we'd like to move this bill along, and I think that all of the committee members are getting the gist of this, of the discussion here. I think we've vetted that out rather thoroughly. I think there will be a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lurie.
Before we do that, I'm kind of with Senator Dibble a little bit conflicted, and I'd just like to check and see if there is anybody from the MPCA in the room today that could help shed some light. I mean, I really would like to support this bill, but I am sharing a few of the concerns, and if there were anybody from the MPCA, maybe you'd entertain just checking to see if we could. I don't know.
Senator Lurie. Is there anybody from the MPCA here? Well, welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kirk Kaduk. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and sorry I was not here earlier. I had another hearing over in the House to be at the same time. I do appreciate the opportunity. This is an issue that was brought to our attention very recently. As MnDOT has mentioned, some of the science that has been brought forward by supporters of the proposal has just been shared with us. We are right now, our solid waste and our stormwater folks are calling other states to see how they handle the situation, to find out what research and data they have. We are reviewing the supporters' research and science. It's going to take us a little bit more time to look at it and see if they're to get the information needed for us to take a position. So at this point, we are still forming an opinion on the issue, as the senator mentioned.
I hope that you were here long enough to get the gist of the message that the issue for this committee is certainly the terrific cost, 1.5 times what it should normally cost to perform this service and to do this work on the roads. And you know, I think there will be a motion to send this on to the Environment Committee, and you can continue to work on that. And hopefully you, this legislation will spur some enough activity that we can get this issue resolved and find a reasonable solution to it. So, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1860, as amended, are we laying it over or moving it on?
Recommended to pass and sent to the Environment Committee.
Environment?
Sent to the Environment Committee.
All right. Recommended to pass and sent to the Environment Committee.
I believe that's the motion that we are looking to entertain. Senator Lilly moves that Senate File 1860, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator Peterson.
This is rocket science. It's like a classic.
You're big brains.
Some of the ones on the Senate somewhere that are.
What's the next one over here? Senator Dempsey, we're going to hear the Senate File 1530 to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think we'll start. What we will do is start out with a delete everything amendment that you'll find in your packet. And I would move Senate File 1530, the A1 amendment.
Senator Dempsey moves the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussion to the A1 amendment? Hearing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. Your amendment?
What the amendment does to the original bill is actually puts in place the mechanism by which MMB would have the authority and the authorization to conduct the transactions, to ensure the transactions that are a part of the main bill. There was some concern that in the event that the bill as a whole goes forward, that there wouldn't be the support on the part of MMB to be able to cut the checks. That as we go through this bill, you'll better understand what we're trying to do. Senate File 1530 is the Contingency Highway Appropriations Bill, and this bill really came out of the discussion surrounding the government shutdown and the effects that it had on our contractors during that period of time, and the resulting consequences of the shutdown. And here a week or so ago, we had a committee hearing to talk about the claims that are being brought forward, the claims of damages that are being brought forward as a result of the shutdown. The shutdown costs, the startup costs, and the related issues, and they are very significant. We're looking at an estimate of maybe $30 to $50 million that is very valuable road funding that is coming out of our transportation budget to cover the claims caused by the shutdown. This past summer, Representative Beard and I, prior to the end of session last year, wrote a letter to the governor pleading with him that our road dollars, our trunk highway funds, are dedicated dollars, not just dedicated, but constitutionally dedicated dollars that go into the trunk highway fund for road purposes. They aren't a part of the general fund. They don't have any connection whatsoever to the argument, if you will, that was going on over the general fund budget at the time, but these are actually constitutionally dedicated dollars programmed into these construction projects over a very long period of time. Each of these construction projects have been in the plan and in the works for years, from the environment studies and the planning of them right on through the construction. And so there is an understanding of how the dollars in our Trunk Highway Fund will be spent for these projects far beyond today and next year. And so what we are hoping to do with this bill is to stop any future loss to our Trunk Highway Fund due to a government shutdown and put in place a mechanism, a contingency that will allow these contracts. And it's just the contracts that are in place at the time of the shutdown. It's not any additional activities on the part of MnDOT or any of the contractors or any new contracts. It's just those contracts that are underway and the work that is being done out in on the road. So with that, I have Mr. Werke here with AGC to talk a little bit about what he saw.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Testifiers, if you could just give us the very, very abbreviated form, that would be great. Thank you. Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors, a Building and Construction Trade Association. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and I will be brief. I think the committee did hear very clearly last week about the impact that the government shutdown did have on contractors, but not just contractors themselves, but on the supplier network and how that resonated through the economy and also in construction jobs. Let me state a little bit about the effect that the shutdown would have on a contractor in general, so you can understand the dynamic. And we essentially took 20 days out of a climate shortened construction season, the most productive 20 days in a construction season, off the docket for contractors to get that work completed. And that had ripple effects because construction is inherently schedule driven. You can't just start and stop. There are sequencing and there are activities that have to be completed before other activities can resume. And then you have suppliers and subcontractors that have to be slotted in. And so that's inherently inefficient when that occurred. And as Senator Gimsey pointed out, there was a claims process that we're now trying to work through. I don't think anyone on this committee, nor do my members, nor does the Department of Transportation, wanted to see money being spent to pay claims for work that was not being able to be completed, and then not have that money go back into creating more infrastructure where it rightfully should be. The jobs market, construction jobs, a depression economy, we're seeing a significant loss of construction jobs in this marketplace. But from a practical standpoint, a construction worker works 8 months out of the year to support a 12-month job that is actually a really well-paying job that has full benefits. And when this occurred last summer, it created an opportunity there for construction workers to not be able to get enough hours to be able to sustain their benefits. And we also saw significant migration of folks who had opportunities to go to other states. And if those jobs get ported to other states, there's a good chance those folks aren't going to come back. That includes contractors as well. And the loss of that skilled, highly skilled workforce in this marketplace when this market does recover is also a significant impact. From our own standpoint, probably 20 to 30 of our members were affected significantly by the shutdown, general contractors, specialty contractors, and suppliers. Some of those folks multiple times over because they had a significant amount of their scope or book of work in state finance construction work. And it's going to take a long time for them to recover if they survive at all. They are now trying to manage that cash that they have to carry as their claim is pending. I just wanted to point out, I did attend a forum this morning, and it was an interesting dynamic that had a number of folks from the commercial finance and the surety and insurance industries, which are significant players in this business we call construction. And they talked at length about the impact that the inability of being able for a contractor to be able to have their financing the shutdown and how the impact that it had on their financing and how it's going to affect them in 2012. If they do remain viable from an accounting standpoint, it's going to have to be recorded in their books. That then, when it's presented to a lending institution, shows it lessens their ability to get short-term financing. It lessens their ability also to have bonding, the necessary bonding provided for them to have capacity to bid future work. So not only do we affect last construction season, we are in all likelihood affecting at least the competitive market nature of this construction season. So we are very supportive of Senator Gimsey's bill. We think it would be an excellent approach to being able to keep what we believe is a very vital service to the taxpayers and citizens of the state, to keep these construction services going and operating and be able to provide that economy in the marketplace that's so necessary in order to deliver a construction program. So with that, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. I think we're going to move right to Ms. Donahue, and same, if you could just keep your remarks very brief, and then if there's any questions, we'll go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. The Alliance members are composed of contractors, suppliers, consulting engineer firms, local governments, labor, transit systems, and other transportation modes. So many of our members were impacted during the most recent government shutdown. Again, I would echo some of the comments that have been made about the fact that basically this means less bang for the construction dollar because of these additional costs. And that will impact future roadway budgets and the number of projects that are available in the future for the work in the construction industry. But also, I think what hasn't been brought up is the fact that there were very real costs for local governments as well. Local governments who also receive constitutionally dedicated dollars through county state aid and municipal state aid fund that have to be used for a highway purpose also had existing contracts and work in place when the shutdown occurred. And some of those projects did have to be halted, either because they involved work within the trunk highway right-of-way or because local governments were concerned about the risks involved in continuing with projects without inspection services that are provided by MnDOT. Also, local governments rely on MnDOT for federal reimbursement. Those checks go through the department. So there was a real impact to local governments as well. One project in particular was a major project in Forest Lake that will result in additional costs for Washington County to deal with, extra costs for contractors and consultants, in addition to over 20,000 hours of county staff time dealing with this particular project. So we also are very supportive of the bill that Senator Gimsey is bringing forward to at least make sure that on the state highway projects that they continue in operation. We think that there should also be some consideration of local projects as well. But this is a great step in the right direction. It's important that even though there's an impasse over setting the general fund budget, that we don't impact the road budgets that are funded with constitutionally dedicated dollars that aren't dealing with the general fund at all, that we have additional costs that simply mean more costs for the same projects. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions also.
Thank you, Ms. Donahoe. Members, any questions for the testifiers or for Senator Gimsey?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dennis.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Senator Gimsey, appreciate the bill. I understand by the Transportation Alliance and DC is interested. Certainly the consequence of the shutdown was severe. I mean, it wasn't just severe in the road construction industry or, you know, affecting the public at large in the transportation arena, but it was pretty severe across the board in a lot of different areas. And the solution might be that we actually roll up our sleeves as a legislature and, you know, adopt a posture of compromise with the governor when it's time to actually pass a budget and, you know, get the work done of the people in time, you know, and that just didn't happen. So the need for a bill like this is actually would be solved by, you know, people willing to compromise and entertain compromise that's offered repeatedly by our governor so that we could actually get a budget passed. I understand your argument, Senator Gimsey, that somehow transportation should sail alone because it's not, you know, all that exposed to the general fund, although it is exposed somewhat to the general fund. A little bit of it is in terms of our some of our functions at the Department of Transportation. But nevertheless, you know, as we know, it's one Minnesota and one larger enterprise. You know, we have separated dedicated funds. I agree. But I still go back to my original premise that, you know, there was a lot of pain caused, and it was probably not necessary across the board and across a lot of the areas in which we have responsibility as a legislature working with the executive branch and our chief executive. So, you know, appreciate and, you know, don't begrudge the AGC, the Transportation Alliance for being here advocating. That's your job. But we have a slightly different job here, and that's to govern across the board and find a budget that works in every area and compromise. Our whole system was built on the idea of debate, negotiation, and compromise, and somehow that's become a dirty word in the current environment. And I can't for the life of me understand why, because it's so fundamental and foundational. The great compromise, the formation of our country, and compromise is somehow you know, some abdication of our principles, and that's just not the case. It's a foundational element of our system of governance, with people bringing different ideas, representing different parties, trying to come to the best solution, and that seems to be so far gone now that it was very discouraging. So I think a bill like this would totally be not necessary if we had actually done our work last year.
Senator Dibble, I appreciate the comments. I think that when you say a little bit, 99% of the funding or over 99% of the funding is dedicated funds, and I think when we talk about reasonableness, you know, certainly I was part of the conference committee that discussed this bill, and this, you know, in my opinion, is one that shouldn't have been vetoed. But that's our, you know, that's my personal opinion, and we're seeing, and we're going to deal with the effects of this. And so last year highlighted that we do need, in fact, to have this bill, because who knows what comes after us. It's too bad that this wasn't in place ahead of time. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm reviewing. I don't think you referred to this letter, Senator Gimsey, in your remarks. It's a letter that you dated June 3rd that was sent to Governor Dayton. And I'm referring to it, but also in relationship to Senator Howe's comments about whether or not the transportation bill be vetoed and the arguments and the disagreements we might have about that. But in this letter, there's a tie of that veto somehow to making that veto responsible for what's happened in terms of these contracts, when in fact it is the shutdown, which is a separate, very separate issue. And we have the obligation as a legislature, when we know the governor has vetoed a bill, this has happened under Pawlenty and under Carlson, that the legislature has come back and created solutions to the issues raised in the veto by that governor and come to compromise solution to avoid a shutdown. That's our responsibility to do that. And some of this terrible consequence, if people would pay attention to it and understand it ahead of time, is supposed to create the pressure upon us to come to the table and have a conversation with one another, because we should share a common interest in not having a shutdown and not having these consequences played out by the taxpayers of the state. So the issue here is not just this terrible consequence from a shutdown to so many people. But the consequences, of disregarding these consequences on the front end, when we had opportunity and time to negotiate our differences in order to avoid a shutdown. So there is not only the terrible consequence for us to consider, should we remedy that in case we put ourselves back into this, what I think should be an embarrassment to the legislature, all of us in the legislature are about our inability to negotiate with the governor, or should we keep it in place and remember that there are consequences when we don't come to the table and talk to each other and resolve our differences in as best way we can, recognizing that we all represent stakeholders, we all have legitimacy at the table, and that we can find, if we give up a little of what it is we insist upon and just get our priorities, we can get a solution. So what this is about more than just what you're talking about as a consequence to avoid, but there's another consequence we may be creating, which is more shutdown if we alleviate the consequences that come from having failed to negotiate.
Senator Sharon, I would just point out that this has happened before in 2005, and also I think we as legislators have a fiduciary duty to the taxpayers. And regardless, you know, the reason the transportation bill was vetoed along with the other bills was because there was leverage. We were used as a leverage point. And I think the more we can do to remove those leverage points, and we can take I think this bill goes a long ways in our fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers and to Commerce. Senator Gimsey.
I didn't mean to interrupt your comments, Mr. Chair, but thank you. And also, we have a constitutional duty as legislators, and Article 14 of the Constitution is very explicit. It says shall 9 times. You shall construct, operate, and maintain the roads in the state of Minnesota, and you shall use these means to fund those activities. So it is clearly a responsibility of each of us who raised our hand, our right hand, and swore to uphold the Constitution that we would do that. Education was deemed by the district court as being something that should continue. But there is no constitutional dedication of dollars for that. But it was seen fit that education dollars should continue to flow. I'm not arguing against that. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't come to some agreement and not have these shutdowns. But what I would say is that these projects are constitutionally dedicated, using constitutionally dedicated dollars that are explicitly outlined in the Constitution, and there is no reason other than using it, as Senator Howe pointed out, other than as a pawn by either side, and it doesn't matter to me either which side is using it, as a pawn in a game of chicken, if you will, on budget negotiations. We have an obligation under the Constitution to move these projects forward and to continue it, and that's what this bill, in my thoughts and in what I want to do, is actually accomplishing.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify as in either favor or opposition of this bill? Senator Gimsey, I see you have a zero fiscal note on this, so is it your recommendation to move this straight to the Senate floor?
That's what I would like to do.
Senator Gimsey moves Senate File 1530 to be passed as amended and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion is passed. Do we want to hear from anyone?
I deport Roger.
Okay. Senator DeKreif, we're going to hear your Senate File 1698 now.
Thank you, Senator Howe. And since we started about 15 minutes late, we will continue on here. We'll end late. But Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you, I have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move. A2 amendment. Then I need to get a different amendment.
Senator DeCryf, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota County Engineers Association, and it basically has three provisions that are intended to expedite the transportation project completion. Sections 1 through 5, the first section allows the MnDOT State Aid Office to be exempt from the rulemaking required under Chapter 14. Rulemaking related to county and municipal state aid programs would follow the statutory exemption procedure, which still requires rules to be adopted, but with fewer statutory requirements. MnDOT State Aid has an exhaustive internal process that includes input from Rules Advisory Committee, made up from county and municipal officials, including engineers. This will allow for new engineering standards to be implemented in a much more timely fashion, keeping our systems up to date. Then in sections 6 through 8, these sections remove the sunset for overweight fees from timber and raw agriculture product haulers to be dedicated to local bridge inspection and weight limit postings. In order to get MnDOT state aid support to increase weight limits for raw timber and ag product haulers, the fees from these overweight permits have been deposited into a special fund to reinspect roads and bridges for weight capacity and post signage where necessary. In 2011, all the fee proceeds were rerouted to be deposited into the trunk highway fund. However, in order for these heavy loads to be safely carried on county roads and bridges, there is the need for continual reinspection and signage. The bill removes the sunset so the fee proceeds will continue to be deposited in a special fund for this purpose. The first $50,000 will continue to be deposited in the Trunk Highway Fund to cover the cost of administering the permit. And in Section 9, this final section requires the state water permitting agencies to confer with local road authorities to identify opportunities to streamline the water permitting process, including consideration of a single point of issuance system for state water permits as they relate to transportation projects. The state water permitting agencies and conferring local governments would be required to report findings and recommendations streamlining initiatives back to the legislature in November of 2012.
Senator DeCryf moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So we've adopted the A2 amendment and are working from that. Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. We're not through testimony.
I thought maybe you had a question to Senator DeCryf's opening
remarks.
I always
like to testimony before I start in on it. I hate when people jump on my testimony.
Thank you. Senator DeCryf.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to introduce Lake County Engineer Al Goodman.
Mr. Goodman, welcome to the committee.
Chairman Gimsey, members of the committee, I sure appreciate this opportunity to be in front of you. I just got a few words to say. First of all, the word is streamlining, of course. And the Association of Minnesota Counties have embarked on a vision to reinvent government. Our organization has asked the legislature to break down the walls of the old command and control, top-down government. And while change can be painful, counties have assumed the role of change agents. And part of this effort is partnering with other local government units and the state of Minnesota for better efficiencies and improved service delivery. Years ago, the counties worked with the legislature to create the State Swamp Buster Act, This innovative law streamlined the wetland mitigation process for local projects. A state wetland bank was created for mitigation for local projects rather than hundreds of wetland banks for individual counties and municipalities. At this time, the counties asked for a similar streamlining in the state waters and wetland permitting process. Similar to the lead-in to the Swamp Buster legislation, the Association of Minnesota Counties and its county engineers asked for an organized sit-down with the state regulatory agencies. And our goal for this effort is to streamline regulations and assure agency responsibility for routine stream crossing and wetland impact projects. We ask that the barriers to providing this dialogue be broken down and that a report back to the legislature on this effort be made. Typically, our county, township, city wetland impacts are rather routine, involving simple culvert replacement or minor bridge replacement projects, some road widening jobs, and it just seems that, in the case where 90-95% of the projects are routine, that we can, break down some of the walls of the permitting process and hopefully work with the regulatory agencies and keep things simple. Just stepping back to the rulemaking process in regards to working with the state aid, yes, indeed, we do have a group within our Minnesota County Engineers Association, a subcommittee that works on standards, the rulemaking process, and we do indeed work quite closely with the Office of State Aid to work through those rules, those changes in the rules, and the promulgation of those rules, and we do ask for your help in streamlining that process. In regards to the bridge situation, as you know, the timber truck and ag trucks have expanded in size and scope, and we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of local bridges that are affected, and we just ask your continued help in providing ratings and posting for those bridges, and also to look at our local road systems to ensure that the damages to those roads are monitored and kept track of in light of the expanding loads due to the timber and ag industry, and of course finally the look at the permitting process. Once again, we just need an opportunity to sit down with the regulatory agencies to see if we can streamline that that effort. We're kind of hoping for a one-stop shop in regards to working through our wetland permitting, so to streamline that. In times past, we could pretty much count on getting a permit in the given year of a project. It seems like our permitting has slipped so that we're looking at the second year once permitting it is submitted. So we just don't want to see that slip anymore, and hopefully we can move it back to be a little more efficient process. So with that, speaking for the Minnesota County Engineers Association as co-chair of their legislative committee, testifying for the Association of Minnesota Counties, we appreciate this opportunity to streamline government and work together to improve how we deliver our services to the public. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First to the, just to the second and third sections of the bill, I think those are actually really good things. And as a matter of fact, Senator Kreif, this streamlining, actually I was going to ask a quick question about that on Section 9 on page 6. Looking at the whole water permitting process, just for the record, your intent is not to in any way lower our environmental standards and our environmental responsibilities?
Absolutely not. As I mentioned before, the counties came on board for the, maybe this is an old term, the Swamp Buster legislation, but, as you probably know, typically the county planning and zoning authorities are in charge of the local oversight of that effort, and of course the county engineers work quite closely with our local planning and zoning groups. What we're asking for is more a process type improvement where, somebody's responsible, and what we've seen is that some of our permitting has slipped because, with all the different people having their fingers in the pie, something gets lost in translation, and I guess what we'd like in an ideal world is one or the other, the agencies, to basically carry the permit, do the coordination for us, and then let us know where we need to make improvements in our situation as far as the permitting, but I guess we're just looking for streamlining and the process.
So, Senator Dibble?
Senator Cry, if you concur with that intent for your bill. You concur with that intent for your bill? I actually wanted to hear from you.
Yes, actually, Senator Dibble, I believe that we always have to, make sure that our environmental processes are in place, mm-hmm. but I want to also make sure that we're trying to be as efficient as we can.
Mr. Chair, I enthusiastically support that. I didn't actually. I tried a long time ago when I was a freshman in the minority in the House to move an idea like this forward, and didn't seem to be such a great idea then, but it's still a great idea, and I think it's. So I'm glad you'll have some success this time, Senator Crife. It sounds like we're just continuing on our current practice with this overweight permitting piece and how we're going to use those dollars. But, Mr. Chair, we're taking the rules for the state aid standards and putting them into the exempt process. If council can just help me understand the one, I have a larger concern that we really can't address in this bill, and that's, why do we do our standards and rules and why are standards so special, and why don't we use the AASHTO standards? Maybe we can save that in light of the time, that discussion for another day. But in terms of the exempt, there's rulemaking, then there's expedited rulemaking, and then there's exempt, which is what we're going to. What is the opportunity? And I understand the argument is there hasn't been necessarily a lot of hearings or public comment or any of that, but that's still a good thing to have, is some accountability and transparency and opportunity for input. What is allowed for in the exempt rulemaking process?
Mr. Chair, we do are fortunate in having Mr. Rick Jonas with the Office of State Aid here and probably quite able to answer that question. And one example of the rulemaking process is we're working. Excuse me.
Whatever you think, Mr. Chair, whomever we could best hear from.
If somebody could comment briefly on this and talk a little bit about it. Ms. Berzovsky, I don't see anybody else jumping up to answer the question. So, Ms. Berzovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, there are a couple of features of the of this particular specified process, and one is that the commissioner proposes the rules. I believe they have to be okayed by the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then normally they would expire in 2 years, but this language provides that they would not expire in 2 years. So it takes the expedited process kind of one step farther in allowing them to be permanent in rules.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, which is fine. Where would an interested party or stakeholder have an opportunity to know what the rule proposed is and comment or have input?
Ms. Berzovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, the proposed rules do have to be published in the State Register, but I don't believe that there is public input that's required, but the public is notified through the publication in the State Register. And they presumably could have input into the hearing that's conducted by the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Oh, so.
Senator Dibble.
Okay, I think that answers my question. There is some form of a hearing, and someone can show up to that and say something. Okay, great. So, Mr. Chair, I have a much larger discussion I wanted to have around this issue of our roadway standards and subjecting them to rule, whether they're our state aid standards or our trunk highway standards. We have kind of a unique way that we go about, which actually, in and of itself, even this process probably takes more time and is more expensive than many, many other states. I mean, I think there actually is a better way than this, but that's That's a big fish to fry, and we're not going to get to that anytime in the near future. But I would, at some point, Mr. Chair, like to have that conversation about kind of our whole process of establishing our roadway design standards. That's really different in Minnesota than any other place.
And Senator Dibble, it would be nice to have that as a complete discussion rather than a piece at a time here and there.
Yeah.
And
so I'll just mark that as an interest of mine to have that discussion and suspend at this point. And I support the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Senator DeCryf.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1698 be passed as amended and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans.
Senator DeCryf has moved that Senate File 1698 be passed as amended and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you. I'm assuming that's the end of our business, and I was hoping for an opportunity to speak before you close the meeting.
Certainly.
Thank you. I wanted to say this earlier on your bill, Senator Gimsey, but the time and the debate was closed off before I had a chance to say two things that I think are really important, since this is public record and there's been a lot of rewriting of history in the discussion of your bill. And I just wanted to respond to the issue of the constitutional obligation of the state. I read your letter of appeal to Justice Blatts, who apparently made a decision that did not meet that standard and
let's not revise history. She did not rule on that. The shutdown ended before she made the ruling. So
she apparently did not rule that whether she did or didn't rule, that she never concurred with your interpretation. So you should not imply in any way that that was her interpretation. And secondly, I don't think the discussion of what the motivation of the governor about his veto being simply to use it as a pawn in a negotiation can be ascribed to him, because you don't know that that was his motivation. There were issues in the veto around the 4% that were very critical to the rural part of the state that we'd had discussions on in this body, for which I thought he had just because it's 4%, it still has critical impact on certain parts of the state. And I think that I'm very glad that the governor was willing to, even though it was a small amount in relationship to the whole, to understand that it's a large consequence to certain portions of the state. So I'm simply saying that when you tied the veto into and laid off the responsibility of the legislature, which I share the responsibility for, not having the conversations, that's us, not the governor, that we needed to do after the vetoes and avoided a shutdown, that's our responsibility, and that we should not relieve ourselves from the pressures that bear, now that you become more aware of what they are, from engaging in reasonable negotiations around things about which we disagree.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sheeran, I just want to respond. I don't think it's 4%. I think it's 0.4%.
I don't care how small it is. It made a lot of difference
Senator
to my
Sheeran.
Part of the state.
My comment, too, about the using it as a pawn was in response to some other discussion that we had in the committee, and I clearly articulated that I don't care which party it was or who it was, but that these constitutionally dedicated dollars should not be used as a pawn in the negotiations of anything. We have an obligation under the Constitution.
I wasn't referring to your comments, Senator.
It sounded like you were, Senator Sheeran.
Senator
House. On a much happier note, if you will, the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association is having their day on the Hill today. A shameless plug for those folks whose work we very much appreciate. And other than that, there being no other business before the committee, we stand adjourned.